Yes. That's right. So yes, letters to Lily. I mean, one of the things I thought was quite curious about it was that it was written to a grandchild rather than a child. Was that why was that and why? How did it come about?
Well, I think probably several reasons, but one of them is that at a time when I'd written to a child, it's got to be to a child, I mean, a young child.
Mm.
No point in telling my children who are
in their 40s.
Know it all or don't, never going to. So it's got to be a 10, 11 year old, and when your own children are that age, you're all frantically busy.
Mm.
And you're actually passing across this sort of information every day, all the time. You don't. The last thing they want is you then to write it into a book. So
yes.
you're actually doing it in practice. The second thing is that, in relation to what we said before, my aims and style changed 5 to 7 years ago.
Mm.
And it was, as I mentioned, Jerry Martin who said I should write something like this.
Yeah.
And the idea also came from this filmmaker, because when we were doing a seminar as part of this Channel 4 television series, we were sitting around a table, and David, the producer, said, now, you're talking to Professor so-and-so, but don't talk to him as if he's Professor so-and-so. Talk to him as if he's one of the 2 million people who might be watching this.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, the only way I can do this is to pretend they're Lily, because Lily was a little girl then. So I would start my speech to Simon Schaffer, for instance, I say, now, Lily. They cut back the time. So I tried to explain to a child.
Right.
And this wasn't meant to be patronising towards the British public, but basically if you can explain it to an intelligent child, then anyone focusing in on a series should get it.
Mm.
That gave me the idea of writing it. Now, the big block, then I love Lily very much. I love my children too, but it's in a different way as a grandmother. Grandfather, and I really wanted to give her something special.
But she has a little sister too, does she not?
Rosa. Yes.
Yeah. Does Rosa not get jealous that Lily gets
a
book written for her?
Next book for her.
Oh, okay.
The Japan book is Rosa's book.
Okay.
It's dedicated to her.
Right. Okay.
So, and we had a party for her, and she cut the cake and everything. So that's fine. But the other reason is that, coming back to these big questions, if after 30 years as a teaching and researching anthropologist, I didn't have anything to tell anyone, not you know, how a kinship system works in an obscure tribe in some part of the world or something, or how some ritual works, but if I didn't have answers to things like what is love, or what is violence, or where did democracy come from, or what is friendship? What have I been doing for 30 years?
Yes.
If we've got nothing, if our discipline, which is supposed to look at all societies and civilizations, have no general things to say, what's the point of learning it? Now, many of my colleagues also have lost faith in this. They don't think it has, for two reasons, which I half absorbed until I came to write the book. One is that anthropology, when it stopped being a natural science, or emulating natural sciences, in other words, after Radcliffe Brown, and it became a more humanistic discipline, with Levins-Pritchard and then Geertz and so on, it seemed to get to the status of something like English literature, on which it was, the textual mode was modelled. Now, if you said to someone who was studying, you know, Jane Austen or something, you know, what have you got to say to the world about human nature, they would say, well, I can tell you something about Jane Austen, I can tell you something about early 19th century England, and a little bit about social snobbery, and one or two things. And I'd say, well, does that apply to China? No, no, of course not. I mean, so that. And that's what it looked as if anthropology had got to. It couldn't answer big questions anymore. And that was because of something which Evans-Pritchard pointed out, which is that anthropology provides no laws. The idea that you have a subject which will teach you laws about human nature, that everyone gets married, or marriage is always like this, or there is always religion, or gods are always like this, or if you have this, you'll always have that.
Mm.
If you're looking for those kinds of laws, as everyone pointed out, the first young anthropologist you meet will show you exceptions,
mm.
which don't prove the law, they prove it's not a law.
Mm-hmm.
And I battled with this, and many anthropologists have battled with this, until I realised the answer, which mm. is that in all sciences, Martin Rees explains this, even in deep physics, there are no laws.
Mm.
There are very, very, very high probabilities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The Heisenberg principle and work in the 1930s from Einstein onwards show that no science has laws, it
mm.
has probabilities,
mm.
very high ones.
Mm.
As you move from physics to biology to social sciences, the probabilities become weaker.
Mm.
I mean, there are still patterns, but they're not as determining.
Yes.
And the exceptions, there are more exceptions, and the things you're dealing with are more complex. And as you move up, say, economics has very strong likelihoods in some, and demography
mm.
and so on, but not always. When you get to something like society or religion
mm-hmm.
or politics, all you can see are likelihoods,
yes,
what I
yes.
call tendencies in that history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this was speculated on and explained by John Stuart Mill and others,
mm.
that we can say that there is a tendency. It's most famously encapsulated in that the most popular quotation in the English language,
mm.
which was from a Cambridge historian in the late 19th century,
mm.
Lord Acton. All power tends to corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
Absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Mm.
The magical word there is tends.
Mm.
Not all power doesn't always corrupt.
Mm.
It tends.
Mm.
Now, this Malthus in his second edition of his population moved from laws to tendencies.
Yes.
And what I tried to show to Lily was what would probably happen. She will probably fall in love. She
mm.
will probably have friends and break
mm-hmm.
up with them. She will probably worship a god. She will probably face this and that.
Yes.
If I could show her a map of the likely tendencies,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
there is a tendency that we will destroy ourselves,
mm-hmm,
or the ozone layer, but it doesn't have to happen.
Yes, yes, yes.
And anthropology, because it casts its net over the whole world and all of history,
mm.
allows you to do what the great thinkers like Montesquieu
mm-hmm,
or
mm-hmm.
Montaigne and others did, which is to look at the deep tendencies
mm-hmm.
that guide our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could explain this.
Yes, yes. It's very interesting to me that you describe that effort as a kind of battle with some of the other forces and tendencies in contemporary anthropology, because, I mean, reading the writing that you've done on the people who've influenced you,
mm.
They're very tender and warm, fond accounts for the main part, and they read almost like acknowledgements pages in
mm.
some sense. And I wonder whether at the same time you must have been influenced in much less positive ways by pain and heartbreak and betrayal and things like this.
Well, we all are.
Mm.
I've been incredibly fortunate. I mean, I go through my life. Some people might have felt betrayed by my parents. You know, they left
mm.
me at school, boarding school, they went off. But because I never felt any doubt that my mother loved me and that this, I understood she had to do this,
mm.
I didn't feel betrayed. I just knew
mm.
she was in as much more agony than I was.
Mm.
So she didn't betray me. I went through school without any bullying, really.
Mm.
I bullied a bit. I bullied my sister a bit. Not very badly, but a little bit at school. But I was never really hurt by anyone at school.
Mm.
Later on, you know, friends who I thought were close friends betrayed me in the minor way they do. They lose interest in you or
mm.
turn against you in some way. But they're very, very small things.
Mm.
I've never been betrayed in love.
Mm.
I betrayed myself in the sense of my first marriage broke up, and it was I who more instigated that.
Mm.
But it was done without too much bitterness, and I didn't betray my daughter by that marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never betrayed my wife, my current wife, in any way. So I haven't been betrayed. And as a result, I have this sort of, for me, I have this luxury which most people in most societies don't have, which is that I start with the assumption of trust and friendship. And 99% of the time, it's works out.
Yeah.
And occasionally, it doesn't work out as well as I hope, but very, very few times, I haven't been betrayed by students. I haven't been betrayed by colleagues. So, sadly, I can't really report being damaged.
Well, that's rather good. It's nice. It's probably a self-fulfilling prophecy to some extent, I imagine,
I mean, it's different for a woman. It's much more difficult for a woman. But for a man, if you go into it with a kind of hopeful, optimistic, people tend to live up to your expectations. This is probably, my wife often says, this is probably my best strength as a teacher. I wasn't very good at school. I mean, I went to very, very good schools, or at least the first one was. And I was really a second stream person. My betters went to Winchester and Eton. I went to a remote Yorkshire boarding school. I always knew I wasn't. I was no good at Latin. I got five of GCSEs. I sort of just scraped through in every level. So I've never, and my sister was more intelligent than me, my mother was more intelligent than me. I've always known that it's only hard work, organisation and luck.
Really.
So I've never felt intellectually superior to people around me. I've met more intelligent people in Nepal than I've met in many places. So I always assume when I meet a student or when, as Sarah would vouchsafe, when I meet someone, I always believe they have huge potential. I mean, when I read that Adam Smith, for instance, went to school at in his primary school with a little boy, and then when he became the famous Adam Smith in Wealth of Nations, the other little boy, who was just as bright and intelligent as him, gone another career path, ended up as the porter at the gate of Glasgow University. And as Adam Smith said, you know, there was no difference in natural aptitude.
Yes.
And I've always believed that. So when I'm with a student, I know that the main thing they need is encouragement. And they will live up to my expectations. And this is why I think a lot of students enjoy being taught by me, because I treat them as if they're just as clever as me, and it's just a shared partnership of learning. Whereas you can so easily, as you know, just extinguish someone's self-confidence.
Absolutely.
By a few critical remarks or unnecessary place pushing down. And some academics who are probably more insecure in themselves do this just to prove their own eminence and superiority. But, and this is one of the many things I like about Marion Strathairn. She's, I think, got this very strongly. She's a very humble person, and she treats everyone as if they're her equal or superior.
Yes.
And, you know, people react very well. And you really feel you are doing her a kindness or supporting her or not doing anything. It's not just the tactic, I know she feels it too.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And what kind of legacy would you like to leave with people?
Well, there are two kinds, really. One is sets of things. That is to say, I would like to leave. I mean, I've gathered in my life lots of unusual materials, films, databases. Sets of materials about remote parts of the world, and I'd like those to be preserved as they are being preserved. These interviews, the Earl's project, my field work in the Himalayas, and I'd like that to remain for, and maybe some of my papers for future generations to work on. So those are things. I'd love it if the trees I planted were also, I planted a wood in our garden and so on, but that may get cut down or whatever. And then obviously, if one has one's ideas have this second life, the soul second life. I mean, I often look at current anthropology and so on, and I look to see which anthropologists are still alive.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those who were very full of right at the top, 20, 30, 40 years ago, are completely, no one knows or cares, whereas others who are rather minor figures or perhaps not have lived and become, as W. H. Auden puts it in a poem about Freud, a part of the air we breathe, and they've just changed the world.
Yeah.
And one would like if one or two of one's books or writings had that effect, and so future generations looked at the world differently.
Mm.
That's the second kind of legacy. And the third is in people's hearts. Basically, it's sort of encapsulated beautifully. When I walk around my garden, which is full of trees, very big, one time I walked around with Lily when she was about 6 or 7, and she said, Baya, which is what she calls me, why have you got such a big garden? We've only got a small garden. So I said, well, it is, don't look at it like that. This is your garden too.
Mm.
And any time you want to come, you share it with us. And when we, and then I paused, she was only little, I didn't want to say when I die, and she said, when you die, and I said, yes, when I die. She said, you'll never die, Baya. And I said, what do you mean? She said, well, we'll be here, and while we're here, you won't die. This is the Japanese attitude to their ancestors.
Mm.
In the little butsudan, the shrine in the corner, the card is put, while the memory of the person is there. So while my student Mark or my children or my grandchildren, for the next 30, 40 years, whether I'm here or not, if they think, yes, I remember a walk with Bayer or a conversation we had, or my student, I've had taught 200, 300, 400 students, if any of them remember me with pleasure, that's the third kind of legacy.
Mm. Mm. Well, that's pretty good thing. And do you feel, fulfilled and satisfied when you look back at it all?
Fantastically, yes. I think Sarah, there's a lovely story told about my friend Peter Burke, the historian, describes a mid-European village which has a church and a square, and the church is in the middle of the square, and the villagers say, we are in the middle of the world. And he asked them, how do you mean you're, this is, as it were, Slovenia or something. They say, well, this church is in the middle of this square, isn't it? Yes. This square is in the middle of the village, isn't it? Yes. This village is in the middle of Slovenia, isn't it? Yes. Slovenia is in the middle of Europe. Yes. Europe's in the middle of the world. Yes. So this is the middle of the world. I say to, often to Sarah, I'm in the best subject, i.e. anthropology, in the best college and department, in the best university, in the best country, in the world, at the best time.
Mm.
If I'm not happy and I don't feel fulfilled, what chance is there for anyone? I've got good health, I've got wonderful students, I've got beautiful environment.
Mm-hmm.
I can't possibly envisage how I could have had a nicer life.
Mm.
I mean, once fallen down occasionally.
Yes.
Had toothache, but peace. I mean, the things that Alan Smith said were the foundations for opulence, as he called it. Peace, a due administration of justice, i.e. safety. I have those. And when you read, you just have to listen to the world for a moment.
Mm.
You read of the tragedies around you.
Mm.
That makes you feel generally very lucky. But
yes.
Through good fortune, I came into the subject at the right time, into the right subject, with a wonderful partner, which is my greatest asset. It's everything I do is really done with two people, myself and Sarah.
Mm.
And so I can't, one or two of my colleagues end up frustrated and bitter, quite a lot of them do, and they take early retirement. There have been times 20 years ago where I used to say to Sarah, I don't think I can stand this any longer. Because it's very stressful, particularly when you start the job, someone like Matt or whatever. It's very stressful. Huge amount of teaching, new things to learn. You just think, I can't go on doing this. But it's another thing, I don't know whether you experienced this at school, but when I first went to each of my schools, the first year or two were like Inferno in Dante. The next 2 years were Purgatorio, middling pleasant. Then the last year or two are Paradiso. You're a prefect, you're the head of the school, you don't want to leave. And the last 4 or 5 years in our department have been lovely. I mean, it's changed quite a lot. I've got younger colleagues, which is always nice, who I respect and like. There's no one in our department who I don't get on with. It's been a wonderful place to work, and King's is a wonderful college. So, structurally, and then I've got this other world, this other family in Nepal, who are loving and supportive. I've got new research projects in China. I'm too lucky.
That's great. well, thank you ever so much for talking to me today. It was great.
Well, thank you very much, Amy.
Do you have any questions for me?
Well, I should then film you if
I was. Right, that would change.
Perhaps we'll leave it at.
All right. Okay. Very good. Okay.